Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Luli, it's been such a long time since we caught up. Now, just before our summer break, you went off to New Zealand. How was it?
It was fantastic. Thank you. Yes, it was my first time in Christchurch, and I was there to give a keynote at the New Zealand Wine Business Forum on the theme of how to grow the wine business when people are drinking less wine.
Yeah, well, okay, so I'm not going to ask you what you said because that would take up the whole podcast.
Yes.
But I did read great things about your speech, and plus it's the most amazing place in the world to go and give one.
It is. Well, thank you for the kind words. Yes, and there was an added bonus that I got taken to North Canterbury and tasted some really great wines, including some lovely pet nat, which, as luck would have it, takes us neatly into this week's question.
Okay.
Okay, so Felicity, here's our question for this episode, and it comes from Christophe, who is based in France. And he starts his email to us with, "Hi, Luli." So he knows I'm the one looking at the inbox.
So everybody among our listeners knows how lazy I am. Okay.
Yeah, anyway, so his question is, why are there so many prejudices against natural wine?
Okay, that's a big question.
Yeah, and we like these ones. We just love these big questions. So there's more from Christophe. So brace yourself, Felicity. He went on to say, are you ready for this?
I'm getting a bit tense.
You should do. So he carries on and he says that he's seeing a lot of natural wine bashing, even from you, Felicity.
What?
Yeah. So he points out that in your Drinks Insider episode with Daniel Rodriguez, where he reckons you implied that natural winemaking is lazy. His words, absolutely wrong. It's the opposite. So, Felicity, care to explain yourself?
Oh, okay. So we've started an episode that's going to get me cancelled from Paris to the Loire Valley, right?
Yeah, and potentially in other places of the world, Felicity.
Okay, so let me start off by saying Christophe is clearly a man of taste and discernment. He follows me and he listens to Drinks Insider.
Okay, so that was a true politician answer, Felicity, because you didn't actually answer the question. So, did you have a go at natural wine, and do you need to go on the record, which I know you don't like doing, and make a public apology?
So I was using that to give me some time to look up the episode transcript while you were speaking. And in fact, it turns out I was making a joke.
Oh,
so Daniel is the producer of a wine called Currently, and he said how important it was to get someone who knows how to make wine because otherwise the product will be a mess. And I joked that you could call the result natural wine.
Okay, so Christophe was right. You were having a go at natural wine, really.
No, actually, I was referring to how many people who've made crappy wines or something has gone wrong and they've tried to pass them off in the market as natural wines. And there are some quite surprising companies that have tried this trick, though my lips are sealed as to who.
Oh, you can't leave us hanging like that.
So turning hastily back to the question, the natural wine movement has certainly caused a lot of controversy.
Okay, so should we start off then with a definition of what natural wine actually is?
All right, so my friend Alice Firing, who's been at the vanguard of the natural wine movement, talks about it as nothing added, nothing taken away. So you could say it's low intervention wine made from organically grown grapes, fermented with native yeasts and produced without additives or heavy processing.
Okay, so that's a lot, but it's not a legal definition, is it?
No, and that's always been a sticking point. So it's a philosophy as much as an approach to winemaking.
Yeah, so going back to Christophe's question about why there's prejudice against natural wine in some quarters.
So we should explain that in the last 10 to 15 years, there were a lot of angry discussions and articles launched about the term natural and about the quality of the wines and about the category.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll read some of those out, those reactions shortly, shall we?
But I'm gonna start by being a bit controversial and saying the upset about natural wine wasn't just about prejudice. So when it burst into consciousness in the English-speaking world, it very much positioned itself as an oppositional movement against the mainstream approach of the day. And as many offended people noticed at the time, many natural wines were cloudy and faulty.
Okay, so why don't you explain the background about the natural wine movement then, as you are our resident history correspondent, and then we can talk more after that about the reactions, the prejudices that we've seen.
Okay, so like I said, this can be quite a fraught area. The natural wine community is quite tight-knit and has been the target of attacks and has done some themselves. Yep. So I'm going to be as neutral as possible in talking about it.
Okay, you neutral, Felicity? Okay, so just the facts then.
I'm scared, Lily, I'm scared. Okay, so natural wine really... Yeah, that's right. It really took root in Beaujolais. Remember, yeah. This is the same region in France that gave us Beaujolais Nouveau.
Ah, yes, Beaujolais Nouveau. So the midnight races to get the first bottle. By the way, which one I did one year, which involved a milk cart or milk float, a ferry and a motorbike. Anyway, that's a distraction. More of that another time. So Beaujolais Nouveau was genius marketing in the 80s and 90s because it was all about urgency, scarcity, people queuing at bars in London and Tokyo and everywhere in between. Do you know, at its peak, it was around 60 million bottles sold on Beaujolais Nouveau Day, so the third Thursday in November.
Oh, wow. What is it now?
Down to about 15 million. And some note that that's partly because of the taste. So kind of fun for one glass, bubblegum aftertaste, and that's about it.
Yes, and some people think that that taste actually comes from the cultivated yeasts that we use. But anyway, so let's go back to natural wine. So the story starts with Jules Chaveau, who was a négociant, vigneron and winemaker, but also a qualified chemist. So in the 1940s, in the post-war era, when there was a lot of heavy chemical use in the vineyard, he began to question that, both in the winery and the vineyard, particularly the use of sulfur dioxide, which is a preservative. So he did a lot of work on winemaking techniques like carbonic maceration and fermentation without sulfur dioxide, and also on the use of native rather than added yeasts.
So was it his work then that ignited really the start of what we know as the natural wine movement now?
Yes, he inspired a group who are now known as the Gang of Four, and these four winemakers were producers in Beaujolais. Mm-hmm. Now, I actually went looking for evidence that they were pushing back against the flood of bad commercial wines, you know, the Beaujolais Nouveau, and I didn't find direct evidence of it, but I do wonder if that was part of the story.
That's a really interesting point. So then what happened?
Okay, so natural winemaking, or what you might call low intervention winemaking, which is just letting the grapes ferment the way they want to, mostly, was mostly a French phenomenon until the turn of the 21st century. Now, I should say that people have told me that natural wine became big in Japan in the late 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's quite a lot of evidence that supports that. So that's really interesting because this, of course, is the period of what we could call kind of parkerized wine. So, which couldn't be more different, philosophically speaking, than natural wine.
Yes, and Parker plays a role in this. So Robert Parker, for anybody who doesn't happen to know, was the influential American critic whose love of big, bold wines changed, red wines changed the market. Yeah. So winemakers from Bordeaux to Napa were making these very alcoholic red wines in the hope that he would give them high points because it meant they would sell really well.
And at higher price points as well.
And higher price points,
yeah. And it's really interesting, isn't it, how trends shift? Because if we think about today's market, for example, we're seeing the growth in wine, what growth there is, particularly coming from refreshing whites, sparkling and rosé to a certain extent as well.
Yes, that's right. But even at the time, even though, you know, Parker wines were a juggernaut, not everybody liked the style of wine that he was sort of standing for.
Yeah. So there was a backlash then at that point.
Yes, there sure was. And it wasn't just to the style of wine, but how they were made. So Alice wrote a widely read article in the New York Times in 2001 called "For Better or for Worse, Winemakers Go High Tech," where she revealed that many winemakers were using new techniques like oak chips or additives like powdered tannins to get the required flavours and textures. Now, this was a shock to many people.
Yeah. Whereas wine drinkers, so consumers, our lovely consumers, thought that wine was already a natural product or a natural style, natural type of product. And actually most wine drinkers still think that today, actually.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting strand of this. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, okay. So at Wine Intelligence, so now part of IWSR, we've run global consumer studies for years. So we basically show drinkers identical mock-up bottles and then change one claim at a time. So one might say established in 1875, one might say award-winning, sustainable, natural wine. Other than that, there's no differences between the bottles we're showing them.
Okay, I'm interested to hear which one is going to win.
Okay, so drum roll, award winning every time. Yeah, it's quite simple, actually. And that's really because this acts as a mental shortcut, so a heuristic, and sort of takes the risk out of the choice when we're choosing between wines or any products, actually. But interestingly, when you add natural wine, so you just write that on the label, it boosts the purchase intent by about 8% compared to the same bottle without any claim.
Huh, that's interesting. So does that mean people are really into natural wine? Surely not.
Not quite. No, it's a bit more complex than that. So what most consumers are responding to there is the word natural, because they already believe, as I said earlier, that wine is a natural product, something that's not highly processed. So what putting that on the label does is it just basically reinforces the sort of vineyard in the sun picture in their heads.
Yeah, and actually this hindered the adoption of organic wine for a long time in many markets, because people already thought wine was natural and organic. And so they wondered whether this new label that they were seeing was just marketing and an attempt to rip them off.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you talk to consumers about organic wine, it's interestingly, you often hear consumers say, well, what's being taken out, or will it taste different because it's organic? Because as you say, there's already this assumption that wine is natural and to a certain extent organic. So anyway, so back to why natural wine, or in the low intervention sense of the word, was growing in the 1980s. So talk us through that.
In the 1980s and 90s, places like UC Davis in California and the Australian Wine Institute had done this huge amount of research on wine faults, viticulture, winemaking, all sorts of things. It was an absolute scientific revolution. Now, people romanticised the past, but plenty of wines back then were ruined by faults like volatile acidity, or they were just badly made.
Yeah, and the answer that was discovered through all this research and to most problems turned out to be hygiene.
Yeah, that's right. But until the 1990s, I mean, it sounds so intuitive now, but until the 1990s it wasn't. A lot of winemaking in Europe was done based on family knowledge rather than formal training. And so people didn't always understand the mechanics of winemaking, and they didn't understand what to do when things went wrong.
Yeah, so I remember wine writer, so Robert Josephs, your former colleague at Meininger's, always talks about how you could tell when you were driving past a cooperative winery because of the smell of vinegar.
Yeah, he's told me that story. So this explosion of knowledge led to huge improvements in winemaking overall, but it also coincided with the globalization of wine that began to happen in the 1980s and 1990s.
Yeah.
Now, both of these things combined led to the homogenization of wine, particularly at the commercial level, and to people making wines to recipes, as per Alice's article.
So that explains the backlash in France, but how did then natural wine spread beyond France?
Okay, so one of the big moments was the opening of Noma restaurant in Copenhagen in 2003.
Okay, so that's one of the most transformative sort of restaurant moments in the modern era, really, isn't it? Because Noma really emphasised local foods and kind of foraging and sustainable production, locally sourced.
Yeah.
And it really kind of spurred a whole new generation of chefs to explore working in that way, particularly in the fine dining sort of end of the market.
That's right. And it, you know, tellingly, Pontus Elofsson, the wine director, famously refused to put Bordeaux wines on the wine list, which at the time was just absolute heresy. But even more strikingly, he did put natural wines on the menu.
Yeah, I remember that. And you know, someone once said that at Noma, you get wine with clumps. Do you remember that? Yeah. And what they meant was that the wine isn't filtered or fined. So, you know, sometimes it's kind of even still fermenting. Yeah. So it can be kind of hazy and cloudy and even have visible particles of yeast or grape solids actually like floating around in the bottle and therefore in your glass, hence the wine with clumps.
So you can imagine the shock. Instead of the sort of the crystal clear Bordeaux you'd expect in a Michelin star restaurant, you'd get something that might be, you know, a bit murky, a bit fizzy sometimes.
Yeah.
But this was the whole point. It fitted Noma's whole philosophy about food and drink in their sort of rawest, most origin-driven situation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then the meanwhile, there were these kind of rumblings going on about the use of chemicals and additives in That's food right. and drink. And that was kind of getting louder at this time.
That's right. So in 2004, the filmmaker Jonathan Nossiter released a film called Mondovino, which very much presented a goodies versus baddies narrative of big wine companies making these high-tech wines versus the little guys who were making traditional wines.
Okay. The way you introduced that movie, Felicity, you sound like you didn't think much of it.
Oh, I did not, for so many reasons.
Okay, so now I'm assuming, Felicity, that you're going to give us the gift of your opinion
on
the movie.
No, that's again something that would take up the whole podcast, so I won't derail the conversation, though I will say among its many faults was the very shaky filmmaking. Okay. So the next big splash came in 2008 with Alice's book, The Battle for Wine and Love, subtitled How I Saved the World from Parkerization. Mm-hmm. And she came up with this term for Parker-style wines, which she calls spoofulated, fruit-heavy, oaky, high alcohol. Critics of her book argued that the natural wine crowd was being too binary. They were making it a choice between natural versus industrial, when the truth was is the world of wine had everything from these highly commercial wines, very industrial products, through to producers who were making wines the way they always had.
Yeah.
So Alice followed with Naked Wine in 2011, and then Jamie Good and Sam Harrop, MW, took a more technical tack with their book Authentic Wine in 2013.
Yeah, so by then the movement was kind of really gathering momentum. So at this time, Felicity, as we all know, you were a wine editor. So how did you react to this new kind of outpouring of writing and books and commentary that was going on about the natural wine movement?
Oh, I thought it was some of the most exciting wine writing I've read.
Okay.
And I have to say, I didn't often agree with the natural wine writers. I often thought they veered too much into a very unrealistic and a very ahistorical view of the past, specifically the claim that they were returning wine to the way it had always been made, which I disagreed with. But they had a point of view and they weren't afraid to say what they thought.
And so you think that's different to most wine writing?
Oh, God, yes. Yes, most wine writing is pretty polite. You know, wine is a very small community and people don't like to rock the boat, whereas the natural wine writers, they didn't just want to rock the boat. They wanted a completely different boat altogether. And this is where we start to see criticisms of natural wine and the movement appear.
Okay, yeah, so we did. So Hugh Johnson also said, why throw away common sense and hygiene to make natural wine, if you remember.
And that's quite a nice statement. You know, I won't go through all of them. I'll just use some examples. But the most sort of nuclear one was Bruce Palling in Newsweek, who wrote a article that was entitled Why Natural Wine Tastes Worse Than Putrid Cider.
Okay, there is a headline grabber, if ever there was one.
And I just want to emphasise, this was one of many.
Yes, yes. We could spend the whole episode just kind of dragging up that set of headlines that came in and articles at the time. So the fight was never just over what was in the glass, really, if we look at what was going on in the sort of in the narrative at the time. It was also about status and identity and kind of most importantly, I think, who got to define what wine should be, which I guess is why there was such a kind of backlash between these two schools of thought at the time.
Yeah, so in researching this episode, I contacted both Alice and also the wine writer Simon Wolfe and asked them what they made of all the furore.
Okay, so get you doing all your homework, Felicity,
No effort spared, Luli.
Yeah. Oh, carry on. Go on, Alice.
All right, so Alice has always been in the thick of it and a lot of the anger was aimed at her and it was often in a very misogynistic way. But she told me, at the time, it felt like the backlash against organic was very much the way there'd been a backlash against organic and natural food in the 70s, 80s and 90s before big business moved in and took over.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Do you know, this will age me. I remember as a child, I don't know whether you ever saw it. Do you remember the programme The Good Life?
Oh, yes.
It was one of my favourites. That really ages me. So for many of our listeners who won't know what I'm talking about because they're either not as old as me or not English, it was a suburban couple trying to basically live off-grid in the suburbs and they had very posh neighbours who were
horrified by them trying to weave their own clothes.
It was hilarious. But this idea of sort of naturalness and living off-grid and producing your own stuff, anyway, it was absolutely treated as a as a kind of joke, really, at the time, except that all the pioneers of the sort of whole foods ended up becoming the sort of billionaires of the future.
There's
the irony, changing the way we eat.
Yes, and I think one thing I should mention that I haven't is that the natural wine movement wasn't just about how wine was made, but also about how the grapes are farmed.
Ah, yeah, yeah, that's super important. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's kind of really critical part of this discussion, isn't it? Because even if there's a lot of confusion about, you know, whether natural wines are the same as organic or biodynamic, and my experience is that that confusion is there, not just actually amongst consumers, but also amongst trade as well. So whereas you can make an organic wine that's not natural, many people would argue you can't make a natural wine that's not using organic or regeneratively farmed grapes. So the idea being that the better quality of grapes with lower intervention, regenerative and organic, this less intervention gives you better grapes to make wine in the winery for natural wine production.
Yeah, and of course, one of the key additives that became a focus of a lot of discussion was sulfur dioxide, or SO2. So Alice brought this up saying, quote, the backlash was very much about sulfur. Now, she claims that refined sulfates, the tablets and so on, were first used in the 1960s and so were a modern additive. And there is, I have to say, there's a lot of debate about when sulfur dioxide was first used and why, by the way.
Yeah. So maybe at this point it's worth just talking a little bit about sulfur and sulfur dioxide and why it became so controversial. So I don't suppose you've written any articles on this, have you?
No, for once I didn't, but I did commission one.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the same thing. Okay. Why am I not surprised?
Okay. So when I was editor of what was then Mining as Wine Business International magazine, I got wine and science writer Jamie Good to explain the whole thing.
Ah, okay. I do know about this article, actually. I do. Okay. So... So the article, that's the one that talks about how sulfur dioxide's been in winemaking for centuries. Records go back to the 1600s, and it's stuck around because it works. It stabilizes wine. So winemakers kind of call it the wonder molecule.
Yes, and I should say it's straying into dangerous waters here because of the difference between sulfur, sulfur dioxide and sulfites. For any scientists listening, we're using SO2 as a term to cover all of the above, all right, even though it's not scientifically accurate.
Before we get told off for getting it wrong.
So I'm going to throw you under the bus, Lily, and make you in charge of talking about it. Could you explain the wonder molecule that is SO2?
Okay, you really have thrown me under the bus there now. Okay, so SO2, as far as I know, from talking to people who are much more knowledgeable than I am, basically does two big jobs when it comes to wine. So first, it's an antimicrobial, so basically keeps bacteria and rogue yeasts from trashing the wine, effectively, spoiling the wine. And second, it protects against oxidation, so basically mopping up the damage oxygen causes. So basically, without SO2, making stable wine is really hard to do, brutally hard to do. And if you don't have SO2, you basically need perfect hygiene, constant tasting, and probably a fair bit of luck.
Yeah. And if you overdo it, which people did back in the past, it can sort of, it can dampen down the flavours and it can make the wine smell like struck match, or as I prefer to say, brimstone. But not only has its use been criticised as an additive, but many natural wine people don't like it because it's a byproduct of the fossil fuel industry.
It is, but what we should point out is that most people probably don't realise is that the modern sulphur comes from the Claus process. So basically it's stripped out of natural gas and petroleum to stop acid rain, effectively. So ironically, it's a waste product that's being repurposed. So we could think of SO2 basically as sort of like wine's seatbelt, invisible when it works and very obvious if you don't wear it. So
it's becoming very poetic, Lily.
Anyway, let's not go there. So going back to natural wine before I get myself distracted. So the backlash didn't go away. It grew at this point.
Yes, and as pointed out again by Alice, 2015 was the turning point. So demand for demand for natural wine was outstripping supply, and the gap got filled with a lot of bad bottles, flawed wines that hurt the category.
I've got a feeling you've got more to say
on
this mistake.
Yes, I do. So like I said, I wrote to Simon Wolfe as well, and he told me that many in the traditional wine world reacted with confusion and jealousy. Quote, they couldn't grasp how wines that broke their rules of quality could be popular and fetch premium prices. The kicker, by calling some wines natural, the rest were implied to be unnatural, a major sore spot for the industry.
Yeah, so I remember lots of articles saying wine doesn't make itself. So even natural wines are unnatural by their own definition, if that's not getting too meta. You can kind of get what I mean there.
There really was a lot of anger about this because Simon's right. You know, by taking the term natural, they were implying that all of the others were unnatural and by implication, all industrial. But so maybe now's the right time to talk about prejudice.
Yeah, so the other part of part of Christoph's question, which is this, why are there prejudices against natural wine? So very conveniently for us, Felicity, I did some homework
this episode. Did you? You're dinging me for doing homework.
No, I wasn't saying I was surprised that you had, but anyway. So I reviewed some of the academic literature on prejudice. You know me, any excuse to get into the wonderful world of academic publishing for me.
Your bill must be absolutely enormous every year, Lily, because, you know, academic publishing is really expensive. So I'm full of admiration. Okay, yeah. So what have you found?
Okay, so I found, to summarise, otherwise, again, we could have a whole episode on this, prejudice from a psychological perspective basically has two parts to it. So it's us making a judgment before we have the evidence or all of the evidence, and then, second part, letting this snap judgment shape how we feel and behave. So wine category and how we buy wine, what we think about wine is really full of prejudice in general,
Rightio.
Not just against natural wine.
Give me the top prejudices.
Okay, so let's start with the expectation effect. So think labels, origin stories, price. They all prime us. Prime what we're going to expect and prime our palate. So, you know, if you spend triple, your brain insists that it tastes better.
So
as
it's
a result.
Expensive placebo with a cork.
Nicely put, Felicity. Yep. Another one is availability bias. So, you know, one cork Chablis, one cloudy natural red, suddenly in our brains, that whole category then becomes undrinkable.
Oh, right. So it's like if you have bad oysters forever after you won't touch them again.
Are you speaking from experience there, Felicity?
Maybe.
Okay. We've also got things like confirmation and status quo bias. And so with those, our prejudices just kind of continue deepening. So we notice what proves our view more than what disproves our view. And so we default to the familiar. So over time, prejudices harden into our habits, into our brain, and into our kind of wired systems.
Yes, and then I guess we you know, affirm our own beliefs by hooking up with people who also affirm our beliefs. So we get
absolutely,
the classicists versus the natural crowd. We get tribalism starting to emerge.
Yeah, yeah. And then we were talking earlier about award-winning wines kind of doing best in terms of motivating consumers. So we have critics and medals and scores, and they create this halo effect, which is what I was referring to earlier. That's the kind of psychological process.
Now the bias is becoming a feedback loop.
Exactly. And then you layer it with things like zombie myths that never die. So sulfites give you headaches. Riesling is always sweet. Screw cap wines are cheap. Box wine is trash, et cetera, et cetera. So the net result, the story, the narrative, the prejudices turn into taste. So you think you're judging wine, but really you're judging your own expectations. And that's really the heart of what prejudice is. And it makes sure that some bottles, for example, never get a fair sip.
Right. Give us an example.
Okay. Yep. So... okay, let me use an example. So recently I was drinking some rosé with some friends the other weekend, and one of them said they never buy darker coloured rosés because they are always sweeter and they don't like the taste of sweet wine.
Interesting. Okay. Now, what's the difference between a prejudice and a mental shortcut, like repeating something you've heard so that you don't have to waste time deciding?
Yeah, well, I suppose they're interlinked in terms of how we build our opinions. So in the case of this rosé story, when I kind of asked why she thought that, she said she'd once had a dark rosé that was sweet. And that, so effectively that single experience became the rule for her. So dark rosés in her head, in her thought process, equaled sweet wines. So she'd formed that belief and then had that behavior set, i.e. I am not going to buy those, and really avoided them.
All right. So we've covered a lot. So maybe this would be a good time to sum up what we've covered so far.
Good idea. So we started off with thinking about what natural wine is. So winemaking that adds nothing and takes away nothing, that insists on organic, biodynamic, regenerative farming of grapes. We talked about the fact it was a movement that started in Beaujolais in France and started to pick up momentum in the 90s.
Yep. Then we have the groundbreaking influence of Noma Restaurant in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And something that we haven't covered, but I should mention, is the first natural wine fairs in London from 2011, and they spread globally.
Yeah, after which we start getting a huge backlash, which we've been talking about within the trade, with commentators seeing natural wine as anything from a scam because of how many wines were faulty or flawed, to wine people getting angry about the implication that all other wines were industrial or artificial in some way.
Yeah, and this is a really important point. I should say that natural wine was itself was partly a backlash against globalization and the industrial and homogenization of wines because it prioritizes the small, the handmade, and the local. Now, personally, I think some of it was also a reaction against the perceived upstart nature of the new world, which in some quarters were not seen as authentic wines.
That's quite a bold statement, Felicity. So there's no nationalistic bias coming in from you there?
Sometimes I get so fed up. I can't tell you how many times I've had to push back against people who think that all Australian wine is either Yellowtail or Penfolds and there's nothing in between. And I have to say the commercial wines of the New World were very handy villain for people, to put themselves up against. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So full disclosure at this point. So I've had the pleasure of working with the Casella Family Wines, who are the owners, producers, brand owners of Yellowtail for many years now. And I'm always an advocate for it. Okay. So Yellowtail is a wine, doing a slight tangent here. So it's a wine that consumers love. In fact, in research, if we look in many countries around the world, it comes out as the most loved wine in the world. When you are asking regular wine drinkers, so a cross section of ordinary wine drinkers.
I'm just going to jump in and say something about that, which is I often hear people say that, these commercial wines are very bad for the environment. But Yellowtail comes from the Riverland region of Australia, which is warm and dry, which actually means you need less pesticides and herbicides than you do in some of the top regions of the world because it's such an easy place to grow grapes. I'll just say that.
Thank you for adding that one in as well. Yeah. So I think it's very easy to bash commercial wines, particularly if you're a wine trade, wine knowledgeable person. I always come at it from the perspective of our lovely consumers, who at the end of the day are the people who put their hands in the pockets and pay for our product, and really thinking about, well, what do they want rather than what do we want? So anyway, in the end, do you think then that the natural wine movement has had a good or a bad effect on the world of wine?
It's had a dramatic effect in both directions.
That sounds like a me answer when I say both. Okay, so where are you going with this? What's your view?
Okay, so on the good side, and this is anecdotal evidence, all right, I can't prove this, but I think the natural wine movement has had a really great effect in general. I've spoken to lots of producers who felt that watching how hands-off natural wine producers were almost gave them permission to do less themselves and to be more daring. And really, it amplified the discussion around sustainable farming practices.
So do you think that natural wines themselves improved as people experimented with that style of or philosophy of winemaking?
Yes, I asked Alice about this and she said we're now seeing a new generation of natural winemakers taking over who in many cases are more skilled than their parents. They're taking more time before releasing the wines, they're being more careful and they're paying a lot more attention to things like high volatility.
Okay, so that's the good side. And in the question was the good side, the bad side. So what's the downside of natural wines in your opinion?
I think the natural wine movement demonised conventionally made wines in general, not just the mass market, more industrial products. You know, they had this very binary Manichaean good versus evil view, which they have strongly communicated. And this has opened the door for opportunistic producers who came in and made what I think of are not just outrageous but also quite dangerous claims.
Okay, so I remember you wrote another article, as always, a number of years ago that was involving Cameron Diaz. I think that was in the Guardian newspaper.
Yeah, that's right.
if you can refresh our memories on that one.
Yeah, that was 2020, which is a long time ago. So Cameron Diaz and Catherine Porter had released a wine called Aveline, which is still going gangbusters. And it claimed to be a so-called clean wine that had minimal
processing. That's right, yeah.
So this was an idea that was taken from beauty. But the wine was just basically a conventional wine with good marketing. But it turned out to be in the vanguard of a whole new wave of wines that claimed to be better for you because they use less sugar or less additives or whatever, which are very conventional wines.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I should say that this then coincided with the growth in the wellness market in general. So before these so-called kind of better for you wines, they were effectively tapping into that global trend that was happening outside of wine, a more generic sort of overarching macro trend. So many of the wines in this category have reduced alcohol levels, which means, I suppose, technically they are better for you.
Yeah, I mean, I accept that in terms of wine, the health problems are absolutely around the ethanol or alcohol. They're absolutely not about additives or sugar. But taking out the reduced alcohol wines aside, I think this category is opportunistic. I think it relies on fear-mongering. They rely on a lot of, you know, throwing the word chemical around. They make outrageous claims about saying that, you know, most wines have anywhere from 70 to 200 additives in them, which they don't. And I think it's dangerous in another sense, in that I think one day there's going to be a legislative consequence to making these kinds of claims. But overall, I think it's a form of disparagement marketing that has done the overall wine category a lot of harm.
Okay. So say what you really think, Felicity.
That's what I think.
Okay. Well, then we are, it is a podcast after all.
So it's my opinion, people.
Yeah, it's our opinion. We're rolling with it. Anyway, building on that, do you remember in our previous episode when we were talking about Gen Z drinkers and we quoted the wonderful Tyler Ballier, who wrote the book Rebel School of Wine?
Yep.
And remember, she said that in her opinion, Gen Z and many millennials see any wine that isn't labelled as naturally as basically toxic or full of chemicals. So she said that in her experience, these kind of younger-ish consumers are so sceptical that if a wine doesn't taste, in her words, like funky kombucha, they'll assume it's fake. And so facts still even won't shift their opinion, she says. So are the natural wine people therefore right to eliminate or focus on this elimination of the use of chemicals in winemaking, I guess?
Okay, so the word chemicals is very emotive and it's been used deliberately to be emotive and as a form of disparagement. I mean, I should point out that everything is a chemical. Water is a chemical.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm not suggesting that the natural wine people are making the better for you. It's a commercial thing that's jumped off the back of it.
Yeah.
But the point is, you know, wine does not make itself. If you leave grapes to ferment by themselves, what you'll get is fly-blown vinegar. So winemakers going back to the dawn of time have used, you know, egg whites to fish out unwanted proteins or sugar to kickstart ferments in cold climates to all sorts of interventions. But generally, people use as few as possible, mostly because they don't want to have to pay for things they don't use, and because it does interfere with the authenticity of the wine.
Yeah, and from the 2024 vintage onwards, winemakers in the EU now have to list everything that they use, which is accessible through QR codes. So there are formal discussions underway, I believe, in the US and Australia about whether to put ingredients labeling, so calories, sugar, what else is in the wine on the labels or not.
Yeah, and I really hope that this is enforced for lots of reasons.
Okay.
So personally, I think consumers do have the right to know about things like, you know, what's in there and also about levels of sugar and so on. But also, I'd like to see labeling just to stop some of the ridiculous claims being made by the more opportunistic producers. But Lily, tell me, speaking as a marketer, what are your thoughts on how this might affect perceptions of wine, or will it make no difference whatsoever?
Okay, so for majority of what I call regular everyday wine drinkers, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. I don't think a lot of consumers will read it because for them, wine is, it's alcohol at the end of the day, it's a treat, and it's not really labels to be studied. Yeah. On the flip side, there will be a minority for whom it will matter and will matter a lot, and that group is growing. So we're seeing a wider trend towards what we call mindful consumption. So people thinking about, you know, not just how much they are drinking, how much alcohol they're drinking, but what exactly they're consuming. And you were talking about chemicals earlier. So processing and chemicals are really kind of under the spotlight, more broadly, not just wine specifically. And wine could get kind of pulled into that same conversation. And, you know, the sort of backlash against processing and ultra processing could hit in wine too.
Yeah. Okay. So I think what we've learned is, as with all revolutions, we get thesis, antithesis, and synthesis.
That's very smart commentary, Felicity.
You're not the only one that reads academic literature. So the natural wine people said that wine had gone off the rails. There was an angry pushback. And now, about a quarter of a century later, natural wine has become mainstream, bringing a whole new generation of younger drinkers to wine.
Okay, so I'm actually going to slightly disagree with you there, because I'm not sure.
Robustly disagree with me.
Robustly,
let's make this
slightly disagree. Okay, I'll do it in a polite British way, shall I? So I don't agree with you there, Felicity, because I suggest that from the evidence I see anyway, I wouldn't classify natural wine as mainstream. I believe that it is still niche. It's important for some consumers, but they're very much a minority of consumers. And I'm also yet to see compelling data that actually shows us that younger consumers of legal drinking age, of course, so Gen Z, are coming to wine only and specifically through natural wine. So there's my
disagreement. All right, you've convinced, your robust arguing has convinced me. Let me backtrack slightly and say I mean is natural wine is now a recognisable category.
Okay, and yes, you can have that one.
And some of what they launched have become, you know, recognisable categories as well, like the Tillable Red. Unfortunately for many natural wine people, it's now becoming a commercial wine. So some of the bigger wine companies are now coming out with wines they're marketing as natural, though this is absolutely anathema to the natural wine movement, which was, you know, it also had a strand that was anti-capitalist and anti-globalisation. Right. So what do you think? Have we solved the problem of the prejudice against natural wine?
Okay, so is this where I admit my own prejudice, Felicity?
Yes, out with it, really.
Okay. So the thing about...
Don't forget, we're going to be cancelled for this.
Okay, we've got so many complaints coming our way, haven't
we?
We're just going to roll with it. We know it's going to happen. So the thing about natural wine is that it tastes unpredictable. So unless you know a lot about it, and even then, it really is unpredictable in terms of the taste. Mm. So let me give you an example. So imagine if you were buying a box of chocolates and you didn't know whether the ones inside would taste like you'd expect, or they could taste vaguely like petrol. So then you go back for another box of the same chocolates, and this time they taste completely different. So that's the experience and my experience that I have had with natural wine. So there's my opinion.
Well, and should I say, this was the experience that people in general had with wine before all of the research was done by UC Davis and the Australian Wine Research Institute. Okay, so I think people are going to write in and tell us their opinions on this. Overall, personally, I think the revolution was a good thing. I think it got, you know, it reinvigorated wine writing, certainly. It got people engaged. It asked the big questions, you know.
But I suppose, concluding, do you have any reservations?
I do. I think some of the criticisms were fair. So first of all, we found out there was a new fault that we'd all never heard of, which was mouse, which is what happens, you know, if you don't use sulfur dioxide.
Yeah.
And as many people said at the time, many, many wine producers already made wine with well-farmed grapes and minimal intervention. So this binary narrative that presented a black and white picture didn't reflect reality. And I also think, and we haven't really touched on this, but I think natural wine presents a very romantic idea of history where, you know, wine in the past is very romanticized. Well, yeah. We know that a lot of what was made in the past was terrible by modern standards.
Yeah, and I'm going to advocate here for what the industrial wines, commercial wines, i.e. the non natural wines, because basically that means that people, consumers in more parts of the world have access to reasonably priced wines that are consistent, liked, and nearly always without faults. So that's what industrial or commercialization has done. It's given people access and the joy of wine in many places at prices they can more likely afford.
Yeah, I always say the modern wine drinker has access to better wine than your average medieval monarch who had to put up with wine that was sour and oxidized for most of the year. Okay, so this is a very complex topic and we've barely scratched the surface. We're very aware of that, but we've also covered a lot.
We have. Okay, so but before we go, do you like natural wine?
Well, I'm really lucky, which is I'm blind to the fault mouse, so I'm not bothered by it the way other people are. When it doesn't have Brettanomyces, yes. I went through a stage of ordering quite a lot of natural wine because, you know, it can be quite easy to drink and it can be lower in alcohol, but it is a different beast to most wine, that's for sure. And what about you?
Okay, how do I... I'm going to put this without causing upset. Okay, the answer is...
No, I can see that coming.
No, I've said it. Okay, I've said it. I've admitted it. So I've fallen into the prejudice trap that I was talking about earlier. And this comes from the fact that the sort of first ones I tried, which admittedly were quite a long time ago, for me just tasted like and smelt like petrol. So that's all I could detect was that. And so it really put me off and built that prejudice, which I'm trying to overcome. So my brother and his wife love them. So for Christmas each year, I buy them some. And okay, this is really going to get me into trouble. What we term in our house, my children now, my nieces, nephews, all of us now call it weirdy wine. and so I buy my brother some weirdy wine. But I have tried to overcome my prejudices more recently, and actually, to be fair, I have found a number of natural wines more recently that I have actually really enjoyed drinking.
See, I don't think having taste preferences is being prejudiced, to be honest. I mean, for example, I don't love jazz. There might be the occasional piece I like, but it doesn't make me prejudiced against jazz because I understand, you know, why other people really like it. But anyway, I'm sure we're going to get a big reaction to this episode and we're going to get lots of emails full of opinions.
We are. And as I'm the one monitoring our inbox, can you make them nice, please? So you can contact
No, write whatever
us.
You feel. Go
as
for it.
Dear Felicity.
That's right.
So you can contact us at aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
And you can suggest topics. We love hearing from you.
We do. So thank you for listening and we look forward to your feedback. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.